This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Take care while listening and email svri at svri.org for resources. What works and what doesn't when it comes to ending violence against women and girls? The answer is nuanced, and our best methods for evaluating gender-based violence prevention and response interventions are lacking.
Tools like randomized control trials might be the gold standard in evaluating health outcomes, but they don't capture the complexity of our work. So the question is, can we do better?
Welcome to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margot. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we are asking how we can guarantee that an intervention has actually reduced levels of different forms of violence driven by gender inequality, or are they scalable using existing systems? While we use a variety of time-tested tools to evaluate violence interventions, it's not always as straightforward as simply trusting the results.
How interventions impact violence is nuanced and complex. Tools like randomized control trials may suggest an intervention is effective, but when we use it in another context, it actually does more harm than good. So what we need is to find a flexible, feminist-driven approach to evaluation. And today's guests helping us in that mission are Lucy Kluver, a professor at Oxford University in the Evidence-Based Social Intervention and Policy Evaluation Department, and Lakshman Belbas, Global Co-Director of the Men Engage Alliance.
So, Lucy, starting with you, when it comes to complex evaluations, what would you say are some of the advantages and disadvantages of randomized control trials as opposed to other approaches to evaluate interventions? And what approach do you prefer to use?
I think one of the major advantages to randomized trials is that it is still the gold standard in public health, or it's seen to be the gold standard in public health. And one of the things that I often worry about is that sexual violence gets continually ignored or underappreciated, underemphasized. It's often the last in the list of priorities, and sometimes it's not even on the list of priorities. And so when you're engaging on a kind of advocacy conversation that's happening at a global level, and you're competing with diabetes control and COVID measures and other public health priorities, I think there's real value to being able to say, we have randomized control trial evidence. We've reached the gold standard of proving that we can reduce this, because it really does help with that kind of conversation. But then, of course, you hit, you know, all the challenges of doing a randomized control trial on this topic and in this area, and they are huge, you know, and everyone who has done a randomized trial has ended up challenged in many ways as we try and think through, you know, how do we do this in the most ethical, responsible way possible, but still hitting the kind of criteria of a randomized trial. And there is some, you know, there is some truth to the fact that, you know, the randomization does provide this kind of good level of sort of belief that we are, you know, making a difference between that this is an effective intervention. But I think we all know it's not the only solution. It's not the only evidence solution, and it never will be. Lakshman, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this kind of challenge of randomized trials.
Thank you. I think it's such a privilege to have this moment of discussing on this topic, which is quite important these days. No, I think particularly looking at the kind of complex evaluations that we are supposed to be doing in the sector. So one disclaimer, though, is my experience has always mostly been within the social justice sector, not necessarily very technical health sector. So I think my response to the question would come from that experience of use of RCT in the social sector. So I think the advantages, I think, of RCT has been also because, you know, this has been one of the approaches that have really helped us to realize also the complexity when it comes to application of this in the social transformatory work that we are doing and trying to measure And it has really helped us to sharpen our abilities to understand the complexity when it comes to social and gender norms change or addressing sexual and gender-based violence. But also it has obviously a lot of challenges when it comes to application in the complex evaluation or complex transformatory processes that we are applying or trying to achieve as part of our interventions. You know, in addition to, I completely agree with Lucy that I think there is a lot of, when it comes to ethics, you know, even within the health sector, at one point in time, the ethics around use of RCT when it comes to from a human rights perspective became a conversation on in itself. Particularly those who come from a human rights background, it became an ethical issue as well in terms of application of RCT. But now connecting that with the, you know, some challenges that we are observing in the social justice sector is that the RCT primarily was made for the health paradigm. And when it comes to health, it was, again, to zoom into was very public health, particularly looking at medical health approaches were, that's where this, you know, evaluation approach comes from. And the challenge that I see is that when it comes to the application of such a technical methodology, when it comes to social justice work or human rights work, is that its ability to really grasp the complexity and the fact that the RCT's assumptions that are there do not necessarily always apply in the same way as in medical or public health too, when it comes to social justice or sexual and gender-based violence spaces. And also to understand that human lives are really complex. And one linear approach such as RCT would not be able to capture the kind of complexity that comes around the social norms or gender norms that are at the root causes of any forms of violence or injustice that we are trying to solve or measure in some ways. And that has been a major back sort of disadvantages of RCTs in the social justice sector. And also the approach doesn't allow the flexibility that it requires to look at going beyond the numbers or quantitative approaches on looking into the changes that we are looking at. For me, I think given the fact we have this as one of the proven evaluation methodology, we need to find ways of balancing, you know, building onto the advantages of RCTs, but then address the gaps that exist in the RCT through other approaches that we can actually figure out. And within the feminist circle, there has been a couple of good examples that have been used in evaluating complex programs or, you know, interventions in the field, such as storytelling, such as stories of change, and such as, you know, I think there has been some approaches that used about triangulation of what comes out from a one tool as an evaluation tool. And the triangulation does really helps in terms of really validating and addressing some of the gaps that RCTs have in terms of approach.
Thank you, Lakshman. I want to sort of ask Lucy to follow on and respond almost to what Lakshman has been speaking about with regards to sort of these different models and approaches. And going back to the first question around some of the challenges around RCTs alongside those advantages, what would your preferred approach be? Are you using different models and approaches? How is your approach to RCTs evolving or changing based on the sort of new knowledge that we're gaining around both the strengths and the limitations of this sort of hierarchy or the sort of gold standard that we see of RCTs in the field, or the pushback, I suppose, towards RCTs?
Like, it's partly a methodology question, you know, with the kind of back and forth of this. But it's partly a sort of much more fundamental question, which is how do we develop and test interventions which are actually effective and which can be scalable? I mean, that's what we're all trying to do with this. And if that's the goal, then everything has to be focused around that. I mean, I've learned a lot from colleagues, and actually from colleagues in very different places. And so maybe if I sort of explain what we've been trying to do in an ongoing RCT, and by all means, I'm not saying this is perfect, because it would be great to hear input and hear how we could do better. It's some of the things that we're trying to learn. So we're working on a hybrid digital delivery of a parenting program, the Parenting for Lifelong Health Program for Teens. And we've integrated into it much stronger sexual violence prevention content, including integrating content from No Means No, which is, you know, another evidence-based sexual violence prevention program. And in doing so, we've kind of stretched the limits of a kind of traditional public health model. So UNICEF, when we started off, UNICEF actually said to us, why are you not doing a kind of user testing process? You know, like Nike does when they're developing an app for Nike. And so we undertook this whole user development process of working, I wouldn't call it human-centered design, because it was I guess, more like a kind of co-development process with families in 10 African countries and a few other countries that wanted to join. And we found all sorts of things that we weren't expecting. You know, we found fathers saying that the only time they used the parenting app was when they were on the toilet, because that was the only time in a day when they had 5 minutes to themselves. You know, we found mothers saying that they weren't so familiar with how to use an app, and so that they were using it with their kids, and that the kids were driving a lot of the conversations. And so we kind of learned through this process that wasn't even really a research process. It was a process that had come from a whole nother sector. And then we started working with Joyce Womoi at the National Institute for Medical Research in Tanzania. And she's absolutely brilliant, because what she said to us is, we need to do qualitative research the whole way through. You can't put it at the end. You can't even predict when you're going to need it. We're going to need it all the way through. And so we did a pilot stage with a pre-post survey, and she did qualitative research throughout that, doing things that I would never have done. Like, she interviewed the low users, the people who hadn't engaged at all. And I was terrified. I'm like, God, they're all just going to say horrible things. But actually, she found out that they weren't low users at all. It's just that they'd had a problem uploading things. So we learned about all these problems along the way. And then we did an optimization study, which is this kind of, I would never know how to do this. Another colleague, Jamie Luckman's brilliant at these. You do these fancy A-B testing to try and improve components. And now we're in the midst of a randomized trial. And again, Joyce and team are doing qualitative interviews, and we're actually changing the intervention along the way as we get this feedback. And again, that's a terrifying thing to do, because when you write an RCT protocol, it's meant to be, you know, set down at protocol stage, nothing changes. But we're actually having to change both the intervention and the trial as we go along. And so a huge example of that is that Joyce discovered in the qualitative work that teenagers and their siblings are using the program. We thought it was going to be done by parents, but no, the teenagers and their cousins and their brothers and sisters are using it. And so now we're introducing a whole new section of the trial to talk to siblings as well. So gosh, I mean, will this mean that we can't publish in a top journal because we haven't followed the exact protocol in every possible way of, you know, we haven't treated it like a pill, that some people get a, you know, a placebo and some people get the pill? Maybe. And that's a risk I think we're going to have to take. And that is a risk, because it's also really important to put sexual violence prevention on the public health map. But is it going to be a better intervention and a better study, better trial because of the qualitative research? There's no question that the answer is yes.
That's so interesting. And so much of what we think about and are talking about is challenging the rigidity of certain frameworks that we, you know, that we think we have to follow. And as you said, that then become the evidence standard. And if it's not in an academic journal, then will you have the authority to actually argue for it? But I think, and a little bit when you were talking about it from a feminist researcher point of view, although it doesn't directly apply to this, is around how it becomes a learning agenda in a very different way when you approach it from that qualitative standpoint and gather sort of different types of evidence entirely to what you thought you would be gathering. And that sort of leads me straight on to Lakshman. We wanted to ask you, given all these things that we've been talking about, what is MenEngage's approach to research and evaluation? Are there examples, either through your work with MenEngage or the many, many other organizations that you've worked with in the sector, that have inspired you from any field?
Yeah, no, I think you definitely raise one point that is really important for an evaluation perspective for MenEngage. It has been a learning agenda for us. We don't know yet, as Lucy, you were saying as well, you know, in terms of the applications of some of the evaluation tools, and whether there would be something that everyone would agree, or, you know, we will find that tool as the best tool ever in terms of evaluating complex programs or complex initiatives, or even such as Meningaze, which works more of a network approach. We don't even have a program, right? But then our intention is for social and gender transformation. So I think we have been using, as I was mentioning earlier, a lot of stories of change approach in terms of our evaluation. But also when we say stories of change, we also need to look, and we have started trying to look at what are the stories that have not changed, to understand the reason why change have not been occurring as much as we were expecting, right? So sometimes it's not only about what happens, but also, most importantly, from a learning point of view, is that also why things may not have happened in the way they should have imagined. And I think that's one. And we use some of the, you know, picture approach, so which is the picture storytelling. So we ask people to take pictures of their own, the kind of change or the problems they have identified, and they will tell us the story of what kind of change they have seen, what is why that change is important for them. So it's very much, as Lucy, you were saying, very user-driven stories of change, rather than we assuming what the change would look like and asking people to just tell their stories around that. And I think that has been a major problem and challenge within the international development sector or even public health sector, is that the way we assume of measuring or evaluating is that it comes from a very particular paradigm of understanding of what we understand or what kind of change do we want to see. And limiting within that paradigm becomes a very restrictive challenge for us, because we may experience, and what we have seen within Meningaze while doing this open user-driven approach, is that there are changes that we may not have even thought of or imagined when we were thinking about our own theories of change. And that's the beauty of user-driven approach, or what we are also started calling as practitioners-led stories of change and practitioners-led transformatory approaches. And other thing that we have also done, as I was referring earlier, the importance of triangulation, is that when we look at evaluations, because primarily we work with around the behavior change of male-identified individuals, particularly looking at transforming masculinities. But I think, you know, what we have realized, the faults of any evaluation is that the way the people report do not match to how that change, what they report, has been experienced by those around them. And I think we really struggle on how do we really make that kind of an for extra step in the evaluation approaches or tools we apply to do that validation check, or to make sure that what change we are hearing is actually the change happening in reality. And I think those are some of the approaches we have been thinking and we are learning. And that's why in the evaluation approaches, when we put out any, you know, we have recently put out a call for application. What we said is that we are open to any kind of feminist interpreted or feminist informed approaches that could be relevant. And we do that as a very co-developed process of developing an evaluation process for us. And that's the approach we apply.
I wanted to just follow on from that, mainly because I think that these new approaches, or those sort of more mixed methods approaches, as compared to sort of what we were talking about originally around RCTs, but also sort of the challenges that Lucy speaks about. And also I think, Lakshman, you'll be finding too, as we're sharing the results from these different approaches and methodologies, that how do we sell the findings almost, or market these findings, or say that it's okay to implement these programs at scale with large investments by governments and taxpayers, and that actually it works? Because what are we saying? How do we define what works? I mean, I think when we're saying that a lot of the understandings of what works is ideologically driven. However, we do need to be making a case for an intervention be taken up by government. And at what stage do we say this evidence is good enough to be taken up by a government to be scaling it up, to really influence and change the way in which we're providing services for women and children, and men, of course, as well? We're going to have to be really thinking around what is good enough evidence to be able to advocate for its use and taking up at policy level and government level. So, Lucy, what's your thoughts on that? And then, Lakshman, also your thoughts on that.
Gosh, Liz, you never stop asking the hard questions, because I think this is a sort of fundamentally difficult question. Yeah. And, you know, like we might want the world to to be different. But something like the kind of hierarchy of evidence is unlikely to change in the near future. You know, and some of that's for good reason. It's not that RCTs are kind of complete rubbish. They're not by any means. It's just that they're not the kind of perfect vehicle for what we need for our topic. I sometimes think, and this is just early stage thinking, is that one approach could be that rather than saying that RCTs are not what we want to do, that do we rather think about developing ways of doing RCTs that do work better? You know, I guess to give some examples, you know, there was this movement maybe, 10, 15 years ago to do pragmatic RCTs. This was a whole new idea. And the idea of this of pragmatic RCTs was to say that people do RCTs and they do them like perfectly, you know, like they fly in 20 psychologists from Harvard into a, you know, a Cuban village, or probably not Cuba, but somewhere else. And they say, right, we're going to deliver this perfect little intervention and then we're going to test it. And then if it works, we can publish it in whatever journal. And of course, that's not useful, actually. And that's partly what, say, a pharmaceutical company might do. They deliver an intervention in these kind of idealized lab conditions, and they deliver it to depressed people, but they exclude anxious people, you know, because they want to make their intervention work. And so the pragmatic trial movement said, that's not how it works in the real world, and you should be testing your interventions as they would be delivered in the real world. So when we test interventions, they're delivered by a government or they're delivered by an NGO with all the problems that that brings. And I wonder if there's a movement for another kind of approach to trials where you say, we do believe that there is value to randomized trials, but in these ways, they need to be adapted. I guess an example that we're currently facing in our trial, this parenting trial, and I'm talking about it because it's top of my mind right now, but it's that we've recently discovered that 25% of our control group have been getting parenting advice from people in the intervention group who are using the parenting program. Now, from the point of view of a kind of delivery, you know, from the point of view of the government who are really engaged in the trial, from the point of view of UNICEF, they're like, great. From the point of view of a randomized trial, this is a disaster because we have to do intention to treat. We have to treat our control group as if they have received nothing. But actually, you know, they're getting a hygiene intervention. We have to treat them as if they've received no parenting advice. But we are now hearing, and Joyce is talking to our intervention group, who are saying, you know, my friend in the town next door, she's having problems with her teenage son. He's having relationship problems. And so I brought her around to my house and we sat down and we looked at the app together. And then she says, and then I followed her up the next week to check if she'd done the practice. You know, and what we're seeing is that it is something where the world that is true, and maybe even the world that we want it to be, is not fitting within a set paradigm. But maybe at that point, you just have to say, the paradigm is not right for this. And we need to be breaking protocol and saying that we will have to look at that control group. They call them a contaminated group. I'm not sure contaminate is really the right word, but you know, we'd have to look at that group differently and ask different questions about them. Are we set up to do that? Is that in our trial planning? Absolutely not. But is that what we would dream for and wish for from an intervention? You know, you looked at SASA. This was what SASA did so brilliantly, was this kind of community spread. And it was one of the reasons why SASA was so difficult to trial, because it was spreading a norms change on a community level. So to me, that, you know, that's a big question. Can we have, you know, feminist randomized control trials? We've got 50% of the population. I mean, surely we can argue for these.
Surely we can. Lectron, did you want to weigh in? And then back to you, Aisha.
No, I think that's interesting. That's a great question, Lucy, to think. Can we have feminist randomized control trials methodology? We do have to acknowledge that when we say feminist informed, there is diverse understanding of even what that means, right? So I think we do have to. But I guess to relate to your question, Liz, about scale up and how do we really convince the government, is one question that I would have is also that do we need to have a randomized controlled trial methodology to even convince a government that these changes are taking place, right? That would be the question I would start with. And are there other ways to convince the government to do scale up of programs, showing the kind of transformatory changes that we are experiencing? And also, you know, one key element in that is that we need to outline the political feminist underpinnings of certain transformation, certain change we are looking at or aiming at as a result of the programs. But I guess when it comes to looking at changes level, I don't think one approach that was applied in one context can be applied in the exact same way in the other context, because the human lives, human reactions, human transformation, social transformation happen completely in very contextual ways. And we have to be open to applying different ways of conducting our evaluations in line with what kind of changes, and then follow that trajectory. And one of the things that I think with RCTs and others, tools that have been developed so far in our sector, is that we come with this rigid idea of these are the changes we are going to measure approach, right? While we know in those in the social justice sector, that doesn't really capture the kind of changes that happen in our community, because, and then that rigidity that exists in the evaluation tools that we have at the moment and we apply becomes a bit challenging to really evaluate a complex evaluation, you know? And I think for me, when it comes to scale up, I get a little scared of also in the on the context itself, is that scale up doesn't mean to me is application of the exact program or initiative and then application of the same exact evaluation tool all the time. That needs to be adapted as per to the context. And I think that's, and we again are zooming into the same one good example that we all know of SASA, and how that their framework of programs as well as evaluation did change as per the, and that's why it is becoming so complex program in different contexts, is that the, even the evaluation approaches were adapted to match to the kind of changes that were observing, that was observed by the people doing the program. And I think that's the kind of approach I would probably lean towards, even though there is a bit of, we will be in a little of ambiguity in terms of, you know, so that's what I hear from some of our evaluation colleagues, is that I really don't understand then what are we really evaluating against. And I always say that, okay, let's hold on, be patient with the change. Let's see what kind of change we see. And then can we come back to this conversation and then figure out these are the changes we are seeing. And it'll be interesting to understand why these changes are happening and why other changes that we had anticipated or expected probably did not happen, or, you know, it scaled our expectations as well. So be open to that rather than being very rigid to what exactly are we going to evaluate, right? And that really doesn't help in terms of, you know, evaluating complex programs. So this openness to that approach, openness to the use of tools that we apply in the field will have to be really little broad and open to that approach.
So at the SVRI, we struggle with, you know, the thing that people sometimes apply for grants to evaluate their own complex interventions. And there are many examples of published peer reviews by those who've evaluated their own programs. And what are your thoughts on this? I mean, is it good practice for us in the field to enable researchers to evaluate their own interventions? Is it not? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, and the majority of interventions evaluated are by, you know, someone connected to the intervention development team. I think there's a couple of ways that I would approach this, because, of course, what we're worried about is that the person doing the evaluation is then got pressure in a certain way to come out with a positive result. I mean, I'm guessing that's your worry underneath that. It's certainly my worry, and there is some evidence that interventions, when they're evaluated by the intervention developers, do come out with more positive results than when they're evaluated by an independent evaluator. And there's a few ways in which I think about this. The first way is that you can evaluate something with integrity, whether it's your program or not. And integrity in this situation is about saying that you are going to test the program as it is, and you're not going to mess around with anything in order to try and make the results look better. And that happens, you know, at a daily level, you have to make that decision. And it's a hard one. And it's also a hard one because, you know, academia and research is positive. We know this. There's publication bias. You have a failed trial, you're not going to get your promotion. It's all geared around success. And so there is real pressure on people to come out with a positive result. And also people believe in their intervention, so there's pressure to come out with a positive result. But that decision, to be honest, is one that only actually researchers can make. You can have all, I mean, and the whole randomized trial system is actually set up to try and make people be more honest, because it's set up because pharmaceutical companies were rigging their trials to look good, you know, and hiding adverse events and things like that. But actually, you still, you know, you can still swing a trial if you want to. And so you have to make that decision, to be honest. But I actually think there are bigger problems than who's evaluating the intervention. And I'm going to be blunt here because, you know, I worry sometimes about the state of the field of research on sexual violence. I think bigger problems are that we evaluate interventions which can never be scalable because they're too expensive, they're too resource intensive. Even if they're right and successful, it doesn't matter because they're never going to reach more than a few hundred people because we can't deliver them at scale. I think that's a major challenge that our field is facing. Another major challenge that the field is facing is that people evaluate interventions which can only be delivered by one NGO or one organization. This is our intervention. And we're going to kind of say that the manuals are available, but actually we're not really going to make them available and you're going to have to pay us to train you to do them. You know, there's a whole set of ways in which we test things, but then we hang on to that thing because people's livelihoods rely on it, because the success of their organization relies on it. Sometimes because they're a particular funder, they say we can't share it because of a particular funder. And I just think that's just rubbish. We have to move beyond that. And I would say that SVRI should say that any intervention evaluation that they fund, that intervention, if successful, should be made open source and freely available to anyone who wants it on the SVRI website. So where are we with sexual violence research? We don't have enough evidence. The evidence that we have is often of not of scalable interventions. And often even that evidence is not being taken up on the kind of national and global level that we need it to. So then the next stage is that we have to get behind the evidence-based interventions and push them. And we have to do that with a unified voice, whether it's our intervention or someone else's. And again, there's a whole load of reasons why people don't do that. You know, we want to push our stuff, not something that our colleague at somewhere else or our rival at someone else has done. And so I think there's a kind of set of ways in which we need to challenge the kind of traditional relationships between funders and researchers, between researchers and researchers, and within that bridge from research to policy, because we're not where we need to be, and we need to move faster to where we need to be. And Liz, I guess you and I have disagreed sometimes because about kind of where we are with the field, you know, how progressed is the field? We're back and forth a bit on that. But I still think we've got to make some kind of concerted, unified changes.
I agree. So is that, I agree we do. I think we really need to be rethinking what we evaluate, when we evaluate, how we evaluate. And we do really need to think through the interventions that have been tested and found to be effective. And think about that, are they able to be taken to scale? Because there's very few interventions that we've found to be, as a field, that has been able to reduce sexual violence or violence against women to scale. Well, they're very few. And those that have require a lot of intensive support. And or when, like Inda Shakira in Rwanda, when we did try to take that intervention to scale, not the SVRI, of course, but really wonderful partners within Rwanda and external, internal partners, when it was taken through a different system, like when it was almost like a pragmatic randomized control trial experience, we found that Inda Shakira was doing harm almost. And so we do need to be very careful about what we say works, when it works and how it works and why it's working. So I'm totally on your team on this. And I do think that's something that as a field, we need to be thinking about, writing about, having more conversations like this to really raise these issues up as fundamentally important around how we're building the evidence base and what we're investing in. because we don't have a lot of research resources. We do know that research resources, particularly for research in low- and middle-income countries, is super limited. And so we need to, if we're going to be investing in research, which is not a cheap exercise, we need to make sure that that investment is on things that have innovation behind them, really thoughtful, creative, new ways of doing things, and is going to be moving the field forward and potentially being able to take up to scale. So we don't need to be wanting to be just testing things that we think no works, for example, but we really want to be innovating. And I feel like we're not innovating enough at the moment. And I loved how both Lakshman, you were talking about the innovations that you're bringing into your research methodologies and evaluation approaches, and how at risk of potentially not being able to publish, you, Lucy, are really rethinking the way that we're doing randomized controlled trials. And I think that's the way that we as a field should be moving forward, as well as leaving our logos at the door, that when we've developed an intervention and a program, that should be available freely for use for people to innovate and create on, and to sort of really do what we want to do. We want to end violence, and we have not done that. Anywhere in the world have we reduced violence against women and violence against children to zero anywhere. And so we really need to be doing something differently. I want to just ask both of you, Lakshman and Lucy, what in your view does make a good evaluation for complex interventions? And how do we need to be innovating in this field to do that? So it does build on what you were talking about, Lucy. So Lakshman, over to you.
So I think, building on to what Lucy, you were sharing, I think first also to your earlier question, Liz, is why are people so afraid of doing external independent evaluation and honest evaluation? Also is a bigger political question, because in the context where gender justice, women's rights agenda, sexual violence topics are so less funded, one is fearful of whether their evaluation will not be able to showcase the kind of results, the funding will be taken away, right? So there is that dilemma from a political point of view also. I'm not trying to justify why people do that, but I think there is a bigger political implication when we think about evaluating programs. And why, when I was with Save the Children, I used to joke with our colleagues all the time that if we compile all the evaluation reports of our programs in the ground, we actually would have transformed 2 times the number of people in this world right at the moment, saying that our evaluations are really being done in a way that serves a particular interest and in the political realm. So I think it has a political implication to that as well. But also another point around that is also that evaluation tools and who is considered well suited to do the evaluation or conduct the evaluation is also political. And the evaluation processes and frameworks have always been developed in the Western context, and those developed in the rest of the world or so-called global South spaces has not been well recognized. Forget about whether, that they form the same level of rigorousness or not. That's a separate conversation we can have. But even then, that's again the challenge that we see in some of the programs. And the result as an implication of that is that I think the evaluation process itself is very heavily Western-driven process that sort of discounts some of the other different innovative process that are indigenous to evaluations in that as well. In Latin America, in some parts of Africa, in South Asia, we've been discussing about some of the indigenous methods of evaluating. When it comes to Africa, for example, the whole process of evaluation in an Ubuntu concept is something that is really fascinating on how that social accountability and ethical standards are embedded as a part of community process itself to one, punish, but also evaluate the kind of changes that is expected from one community. So I think some of those innovations we need to bring up more. And I think the challenge to that is again that those are become not so well accepted in the evaluation sector, which is quite academically driven as well. Not to say that all academician colleagues are falling into that, but heavily it falls under that, in terms of one of the great evaluation that I did on one of the programs with Save the Children when I was there was actually done together with Institute of Reproductive Health, Rebecca and colleagues, was the use of photo stories. I learned from that project. And it was quite an interesting with children. We asked them to go in the community and then, take pictures and tell their stories. So I think, how can we build onto these cultural processes that can actually inform the evaluation methodologies is something that I would definitely urge that we start thinking about evaluation. But I think, as much as possible, we do need to be open to external evaluation and honest evaluation of the changes. Otherwise, we are just fooling around, really not making about the kind of change we are really anticipating to achieve.
You know, I've been thinking, Lakshman, as you've been speaking about, you know, how right you are about the complexity of the world and the kind of subtlety of what we're trying to do. And something occurs to me that I wish that we could understand how to do better. And that's whether we could get the best of both worlds. You know, could we integrate the kind of iterative learning that you're doing, the building of knowledge without thinking that you understand what you're going to get at the end of it. The questioning of even, you know, what does it mean when someone reports that their violence has reduced? And does the perception and experience of violence differ depending on who you are in the situation? And could we build that better into an evaluation methodology that still gets us the rigor and the capacity to make the argument, you know, to the Ministry of Finance, to the global stage of public health? Is there a way that we could sort of move forward to have that deeper understanding? And maybe most fundamentally, that needs to come at earlier stages, actually. You know, by the time you get to RCT, there's, you know, you can tweak at the edges. But often our interventions are not built on the kind of thoughtfulness and openness that you've described. And I think we could do better to make them.
We have to keep up with our differences and find ways to collaborate. And I think that's how we will only be able to achieve the kind of objective we all have, but find ways to connect on our differences and rebuild. And Lucy, I absolutely agree. Can we find ways of working together and be innovative and create innovative tools and technologies that we can be rigorously advocating for in terms of evaluating complex programs? So I strongly believe let's keep up, let's challenge each other on the knowledge front, and I'm sure we will find a beautiful outcome through that process that can be helpful or may be helpful better.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks to our guests, Lucy Kluver and Lakshman Belbas.
We've lined up loads more incredible speakers for the rest of this new series, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo, and you've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit www.svri.org.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.